Go ahead, Rebecca, start the episode off.
Welcome back. Thanks for joining us today. Today we're going to be talking about term and near-term babies and kind of what that looks like, what we see.
Yeah, how often do we see near-term, full-term babies in the NICU?
For a drive-by or a stay?
Both.
That's a fair question. Actually, the last shift I worked, it was a drive-by. Solid 20 minutes. Thank you for coming. We appreciate your presence in the unit. Go back to your mom. Have a nice day. For stays, I feel like we don't see that very often, although I'll be real honest with y'all. If I see a near-term, term baby in the NICU, it makes me a little anxious.
What about that makes you anxious?
They're not supposed to be there.
They're not supposed to be there.
They're totally not supposed to be there. There is no reason for that baby to make it into our population.
Theoretically, these babies are healthy. They should be with their moms, and they should be with their families in newborn care, really. You know, I know we recently saw a baby with a pretty rare genetic anomaly, and their outcome is just not good.
Yeah, I feel like when you talk about term and near-term babies, most of what we're seeing is either genetics, known or unknown. A lot of times they are things that have been seen on ultrasound that we're anticipating. We have had those cases. I remember having newborn call and ask us if we could come evaluate a lesion on the baby. They weren't quite sure what it was. And I went to look to kind of see if the practitioner needed to go or if it was just something that we could dismiss. Not dismiss, but you know.
Like, wait until the practitioner was making rounds.
Right. Or if it was something that we needed to do right away. And when I went and looked, I remember geeking out for just a second, out of the room, y'all, not in front of the parents, I promise, and going to find the practitioner. And I said, I've never seen it before in real life. I've only seen it in textbooks, but I'm pretty sure it's cutis aplasia, and we need to go look right now. And we went, and the baby was about 2.5 hours old when we went for the evaluation. And at the time of delivery and initial assessment, the newborn nursery nurses felt like the baby looked okay. And as we started doing a little bit deeper assessment, I noticed that the ears are a little low set and maybe the eyes were a little oddly shaped and the nasal bridge might be a little bit flat, and the cutis aplasia was there on the back of the baby's head, and there was a simian crease on one hand, and that was about the point the attending told me to stop finding things wrong with the baby. And it turned out that she had a really rare genetic anomaly that we didn't find on ultrasound, that we didn't know anything about until they called to ask us about this skin lesion about, you know, the size of a quarter on the back of the baby's head. So sometimes, you know, the genetics are known. Did y'all know, by the way, I think this is the coolest thing, that a bigger than normal gap between the great toe and second toe on ultrasound is one of the major prenatal markers for a trisomy.
I did know that.
I think I'd heard it somewhere, but you know, it's one of those things that's flicked in my brain. And
so when we see things like that on ultrasound, it does kind of, you know, give us an indication that it's maybe something that we should be ready for. But a lot of genetics are something that you don't see until the baby is born. And then I think the other one is congenital hearts, because obviously prenatal heart function may or may not reflect what we would see after birth.
Right. If there's only one prenatal ultrasound at 18 to 20 weeks, sure, something like a coarctation could be missed.
And a lot of times, you know, the congenital heart things, well, first of all ultrasounds are only as good as your tech. And I feel like if you get your one, like you said, your one prenatal scan at 18 or 20 weeks and everything else has been kind of normal, that tech might not be used to working at a level where they would find those things, versus if you were at maternal fetal medicine specialty clinic, or if you were being closely watched, or if your tech happened to work at a facility that's used to screening for congenital hearts, they might see things that somebody's regular normal experience wouldn't see. the same way that
Well, I guess I'm just kind of hoping that you would like retract the statement about the ultrasound being as good as the tech. I think the ultrasound is as good as the technology. Each prenatal ultrasound there are set measurements that need to be taken in the prenatal profile. And so you're taking measurements. Each prenatal ultrasound has those certain measurements. So you're measuring cardiac flow. You're measuring femur length, looking to see if there's a fat pad, looking at certain markers in the brain, markers on the heart, measuring the amniotic fluid index. So I wouldn't say that the ultrasound's as good as the tech, but sometimes you're not getting technology. You might be using older equipment. So when somebody then goes to a maternal fetal specialist, those ultrasounds are more in depth.
See, and I agree to a point. I think the reason why I said that it's as good as the tech, having come from a center that does congenital hearts, I know that those physicians will only allow certain techs to do their echoes because there is something, yes, those measurements have to be had, but there are also additional views and scans that can show them things. And the reason that I said what I said, because I said what I said, y'all. So I had a primary. Mom had 4 prenatal ultrasounds, including 2 that were the 4D, which is the best technology that we have. And on all 4 prenatal ultrasounds, there was nothing read as abnormal. The baby was born at 36 weeks in an outlying facility and was transferred to the center that I was in at the time for rule out congenital heart. When she was about 12 hours old, went to breast, was a little cyanotic, not really eating well. Classic, I feel like, things that would make them indicate suspicion for a congenital heart. When she came to us, we got an echo and it turned out that she had a left ventricle full of rhabdomyomas with only a serpentine canal of the left ventricle. So what I saw, and I guess this is my ignorance and understanding, but what I saw was you had the best technology, but because you were coming from a smaller facility that isn't necessarily looking with that same degree of suspicion, they got the measurements that they got, they hit the numbers that they were supposed to hit, and life moved on.
I can remember with one of my ultrasounds, the tech telling me, because they said, I don't see one of the chambers of the heart. And I was like, oh, no, you need to find all 4. And we were having a discussion, and I remember her saying to me, you know, a lot of congenital heart defects are found as a fluke. It's a complete fluke that it is found on that ultrasound. So I don't know that it's necessarily the technology. I don't know that it's necessarily the tech. I think it's your experience. What have you seen in your career to make you look for those things?
What I think I meant by the tech is like, where is your level of suspicion? What are you looking for?
Well, and I also think too, there's a lot to be said about the positioning of the baby in the prenatal Absolutely. Ultrasound. You know, like Michelle said, a lot of our congenital hearts are found, if it is found on ultrasound, it's found as a fluke. You know, a lot of moms now are getting genetic screening done at 12 weeks. And so if you have a baby who has trisomy 21, 18, 13, then that level of suspicion increases. But if you have a mom who comes in for a routine prenatal ultrasound who has a genetic screen that is negative for all of the things that are tested, sure, then your level of suspicion is lowered.
Right.
And that's fair to say, okay, it should be, you shouldn't be on high alert for genetic screen that looks fine. You know, and I also, this is kind of how I practice. Not every prenatal ultrasound deserves a high level of suspicion.
Which is true. And you and I have talked a lot about the difference in, I'm pretty much convinced that every baby is broken all the time. Because in my experience, every baby is broken all the time. Because I don't have experience with well babies.
Right.
Which, I mean, it does change your perspective a lot. And also, let me say, while I said it has a lot to do with the tech, that's not said with any judgment. It is about your experience and exposure. I was super proud of myself to be able to say I thought a baby didn't need to go to the NICU, because I meet babies in the grocery store and I'm convinced that they're broken until you can prove to me that they aren't.
Yeah. Yeah. So, yeah, I mean, we're talking about early term, full term. Gestationally, your early term is 37 weeks and 0 days to 38 weeks and 6 days. Full term is 39 and 0 days to 40 and 6 days. These babies traditionally stay in newborn nursery. When we see them in the NICU, I would say most often when we see them in NICU, these babies have transient tachypnea of the newborn. They have some fluid in their lungs that they need to work out, and they stay with us for a couple of days. They go home without any kind of long-term deficits from the TTN that they had. Would you guys agree?
I think the other thing...
And blood sugars.
It is blood sugars.
Right. Blood sugars.
Or there was a setup. One thing that we've started using is the neonatal sepsis score.
Oh, yes.
If they are a setup with that, they score them, the doctors score them at birth. And if that score shows that that baby needs antibiotics or needs a further workup, that baby is going to come to the NICU. So those are the three categories, I think, that are the
right
most likelihood outside of a congenital anomaly to get someone sent to us.
So it used to be that babies who were set up for sepsis would stay in newborn nursery.
I was just going to ask that.
But with the introduction of antibiotic stewardship and the early onset sepsis scoring calculator, whatever you guys call it at your facility, we're seeing less and less babies on antibiotics. So those babies who do require antibiotics are presenting sicker and sicker. They need a higher level of care. They should not be in the room.
And the other piece of that too is your baby-friendly hospitals no longer have a nurse in a baby-friendly nursery. Having a baby with an IV is most facilities is considered practicing outside of your scope of practice. Hence why they also end up in the NICU for antibiotic treatment.
Okay, so correct me if I'm wrong, but isn't it true that there was once upon a time where babies would get a D10 bolus in the newborn nursery before they came to NICU?
Yes, ma'am.
Yes, ma'am. So when I went to newborn and we were transitioning to baby friendly, I called a pediatrician about a baby who was having some blood sugar issues. That pediatrician ordered a D10 bolus, and I gave that D10 bolus in the newborn nursery. And 2 days later, I was having to explain myself to my nurse manager.
I feel like I wouldn't have even thought about it. I would have just done it.
I did not even think twice about it. I was like, yeah, we do this.
Yeah. I mean, and I say that in being a charge nurse in the NICU, when our census is high and we're trying to get newborn to manage a baby that should, in theory, stay with mom. And the answer I got was, it is now considered to practice outside of your scope of practice in the newborn nursery with an IV.
I have no idea. I can't even tell you how many times I remember early in my practice, because I put PICC lines in. So if there was anything small anywhere in the hospital that needed an IV, they would call whoever was the PICC inserter, and I would go start IVs in newborn.
That is, I mean, not all facilities practice that way, but I know that is one thing that I ran into.
As part of baby friendly.
As part of baby friendly. And I don't know that even all baby friendlies practice that way, but just as someone listening, keep that tucked in the back of your mind.
Yes, if you go from NICU to newborn, keep that in the back of your mind. I definitely did not think twice about it. I gave a D10 bolus in newborn nursery. That was probably 11 years ago now.
Yeah, right. That's probably when baby friendly was really well. Let's see, baby friendly is probably...
It's probably about 10 years old.
My middle child was born during a hospital transitioning, and he's 14.
Yeah.
So I feel like baby friendly's 14, 15 year old.
And yep. Don't worry, listeners, because my nerd brain is running a million miles a minute. I promise you, if you go on the website underneath this episode, you will find all the links that will explain all of the baby friendly and specifics, because now I need to know.
Yes.
That's the way it goes.
All the things that we bring up, that if you don't function in charge roles or you don't function, you don't necessarily see or hear.
Yeah, you
well,
don't
I'm curious
know.
As we're talking what the specifics of baby friendly are versus facilities. Mm-hmm. Like you were saying, you didn't know if all facilities practice that way. I know when the facility that we used to be at went to baby friendly, there was a lot of discussion about binkies.
Oh, pacifiers in the NICU?
Wanting pacifiers in the NICU, not in the NICU. Baby friendly says no. Developmentally for the NICU, it's inappropriate to say no. Those children only have a few ways of self-soothing.
So it's really interesting. I was just reading some literature on blood sugar babies, and the support for not giving blood sugar babies pacifiers is actually really weak.
It should be.
It is very weak. There's really not a lot of research that says babies should not have pacifiers. And there's not a lot of research that says giving a pacifier, the research doesn't, it doesn't really support not giving breastfed babies pacifiers.
In my experience, what I find is what we call nipple confusion is actually instant gratification issues.
Correct. I would 100% agree with that.
If you get mom to put herself on the pump for 30 seconds or to pinch her nipples until they elongate, really the baby doesn't care.
Yep. Like if you can get some colostrum at the end of the nipple, a baby does not care.
And I think it's interesting, a lot of the baby-friendly stuff, first of all, I'm going to say is above my pay grade or outside of my own personal scope, because again, I think that every baby is broken all the time. But it's interesting to see how much of it is really based on the perception of what a well baby should get versus any kind of understanding really of what the NICU does.
Right. I think we could do a whole episode on baby friendly, to be perfectly honest with you.
Probably.
Stay tuned.
Okay. So as we're talking about near-term term babies.
Yes. Yeah. Let's talk. Do you want to talk about newborn care?
Sure.
Okay.
That's all you.
Okay. Newborn care is, I mean, baby comes out. Baby comes out, go skin to skin, delayed cord clamping. Again, a whole other podcast.
I was just about to say, ooh, are we going to talk about that? Or are we going to save that for another day?
I actually feel like we might have some fighting words during the delayed cord clamping episode.
Who, me and you?
All of us. Okay, stay maybe. Tuned. That'll be another episode. So yeah, so baby comes out, delayed cord clamping, 30 seconds to a minute is what I've traditionally seen. Baby comes out, 9-9 Apgars. I used to say that I'm not superstitious, but I am. And in my career, I think I've given a 5-minute Apgar of 10, maybe twice.
Oh, I only know of the one time that you called me and you were like, oh my God, the baby was a 10 and 10.
No, it was.
Or it was a 9 and 10?
It was like a 9 and 10. And I'm telling you, I was looking for just a little bit of blue on those feet. And this baby was truly a 10. The next baby that delivered that I was baby nurse for, the Apgars were 1, 3, and 8.
Oh, no.
And so when I say I'm not superstitious,
nobody will get a 10 again.
I mean, if they truly deserve a 10, I'll give them a 10. But then I get really nervous for that next baby to roll along.
True. I feel like Apgar scoring might be something worth talking about quickly with our newborn here, too.
Yeah, sure. I think Apgar scoring. Tell me, what are the points? What are the points, Rebecca?
Why are you asking me when you know that you're the baby girl? All right, so you get...
Because I want to know that I taught you right.
You
this
did.
Is a teach back moment.
You did actually teach me right, and I was very, very proud of myself for remembering. So you
I'm
get
proud
2
of
points
you.
For color, assuming that your color is pink all the way through and not what I saw the other day in delivery. Mm-hmm. You get 2 points for heart rate, 2 points for breathing.
Wait a minute. So you get 2 points for heart rate if what?
Okay, so 1 point if it's beating but less than 100, 2 if it's 100 or better. Mm-hmm. So I was initially taught that if you can grab the umbilical cord and dance to it, it's a 2. And then 1 if it's better than 60. Color would be 2 points if the baby is all pink, 1 if there's some acrocyanosis, and 0 if it's the color of blueberries. Mm-hmm. I always think of Violet. You're turning Violet. Violet from Willy Wonka.
You are turning Violet. Violet.
2 points if we have good tone, meaning midline inflexed, because all babies want to be midline inflexed all the time. 1 point if you're trying to do that, but not doing a great job at it. And then no points if you're a dish rag in the bed.
What if you're a 30-weeker and, you know, you have 30-weeker tone?
Do you give 2? I think if you're making an effort, even for 23-weeker tone, if you're making an effort.
Yeah.
Although I also think it would be a little ridiculous to think that a 23-weeker would ever get a 2 for any of the things.
Right. Except for heart rate.
Except for heart rate.
Yeah.
And then 2 if your respiratory effort is good and sustained and prolonged. 1 if you kind of gasp and then quit.
Yeah.
And reflex. If they are angry with me for being annoying.
Yeah.
They get a 2. If they kind of then they get a 1. Mm-hmm. And otherwise they don't get any. Did I get it right?
You got it right.
Yay!
So I had a midwife one time tell me, because I assigned Apgars of 8 and what was that second one? It was like 8 and 5.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. And then, of course, we did a 10-minute one. Which, all right, she was a 36-week baby born to a mom on magnesium sulfate. So it stands to reason that she would come out with lots of energy. And then she just was like, I'm kind of tired.
Right.
And so this midwife told me that I must be wrong, because Apgars don't ever decrease.
An untrue statement.
Untrue.
And that is what I said. That is an untrue statement.
Right. If you have perfusion initially, but it's really kind of a side effect of mom, and now the baby has to sustain it on their own and doesn't.
Or you got the meconium aspiration that, I screamed coming out, but now...
Mm-hmm. My lungs are full.
My lungs are full of poo and I can't do anything else.
I can't do it. Yep.
Right. So normal newborn care, assuming that our Apgars are not 1.
Right.
1.
So baby comes out.
I think was 0, 1, 1, and 3.
Mm-hmm. That sounds pretty bad.
It was pretty bad.
So yeah, our Apgars come out. We look good. Dry, stimulate, leave baby with mom. Within the first hour or so, baby really has a good alert, awake period. And that's a good time to initiate breastfeeding if that's what the family's choice is. If the family's choice is to bottle feed, that would be a good time to initiate feeds. And then the babies for the first 24 hours generally have a really kind of sleepy period where the parents are trying to wake them up every 2 to 3 hours to feed. Mom and dad are really frustrated because the baby's not waking up. Is probably the most common conversation that I have with parents in that first 24 hours is that you do have to wake baby up to get them latched on. Mom generally has to do some hand expression to try to encourage the baby to eat. Lots of skin to skin in that first 24 to 48 hours. I encourage dads to do skin to skin so that mom can rest with baby friendly. I mean, parents are exhausted.
Right.
And we really need to talk to them about tag teaming, taking care of this baby. And it cannot all fall on mom because mom needs to sleep at some point. So there's skin to skin. I tell parents when you're doing skin to skin, it's really important to make sure that you have a blanket over the baby. Because if you're doing skin to skin and the baby's back is exposed, that's 50% of the baby's body surface area that's exposed to the air. And it's not reasonable to think that the baby can thermoregulate that.
So it's really interesting. Susan Luddington Ho is the nurse researcher who's done the bulk of the body of literature for kangaroo care. And she says that moms work like an incubator. Mom will get warm when the baby is cold. Mom will try and cool off when the baby gets hot. If you've ever done kangaroo care in the NICU, you hear these moms go, I'm sweating to death or I'm freezing. When really what they're trying to do is accommodate for the baby. But you're right. That drafty piece, I think people a lot of times forget about, because mom can only do so much of a surface. And Susan Luddington Ho says that men have terrible boobs because daddies cannot cool off. So babies, when they skin to skin with dad, are always hyperthermic in her research. When you put the baby back in the bed, because dad can get hot but can't cool off. And even at that, dad can only regulate what they're touching, you know. So you're right. I think that blanket piece is super important. She also says for skin to skin, though, it's important to verbalize to mom that mom works like an isolette, because she found in her research that implanting that makes it more effective and helps it happen more quickly. So she said, if you whisper to a mom, "I think your baby's getting cold," mom's skin temperature will actually go up 2 degrees in 5 minutes. Just crazy to think about.
Moms are so cool.
Babies are so cool too. Mm-hmm. And together, it's awesome. I do. I keep waiting for it to stop being awesome, and it hadn't happened yet.
Mm-hmm. That's really cool. So yeah, the first 2 days while in the hospital for newborn care, it really is. It's teaching the parents how to feed the baby, get the baby latched on, watching for urine and stools, teaching the parents. A lot of it is education with new parents. I know sometimes, you know, you get the parents who've had, this is their third baby, and you kind of go in and they know the routine. Sometimes they have questions, sometimes they don't. A lot of it is really just, it's educating and getting this family ready to take their new family member home.
Right. And mm-hmm. So when you get to that point, you've checked all the boxes, you've done all the things, you're 36 or so hours out, and the ductus starts to
close. And then, so we do, in newborn care, you have a congenital heart screen. It's a pulse ox that you place on the right hand and ideally a lower extremity. And you're looking to see if there's a significant difference between the two readings.
I have to share, because this was another geek out moment. There was one nurse on one unit somewhere in the middle states.
The Midwest.
I should know that, but I don't remember which one. Her nursing research project that she wanted to do, just for like a clinical ladder, was to check this pulse oximeter reading pre and post ductal. Mm-hmm. She found that they were missing a lot of congenital hearts that were going home and then coming back after discharge for the baby's blue. And so she did that in her one unit, and they found such great data. Her hospital was part of a system, so the system adopted it, and they found such great data that the state adopted it, and now it is a national standard because of one nurse, y'all, because nurses are cool too.
And so the other thing we do for newborns, either your hospital calls it 24-hour testing or they call it discharge testing. Either way. Then the other test that's done is a transcutaneous bilirubin level. We have done this at 24 hours for all of the facilities that I've worked at. The difference between facilities that I've seen, some facilities do the transcutaneous bilirubin test on the forehead. Some do it on the chest.
What's the difference?
You're going to get a higher reading on the forehead because jaundice starts at the head and works its way down. I would say that doing the TC Billy on the forehead is more conservative management. And so if you get that higher reading on the forehead, you might get a Billy level from a heel stick that is significantly lower.
Got it.
And then once that baby, actually, I kind of want to touch down on this too. Once the baby has been under Billy lights, you can no longer do the transcutaneous bilirubin level.
Why?
Because the bilirubin level has been conjugated,
yes,
by the light.
Right. Fair.
And
I
so
I never thought about it.
Right. And so now you're going to get an inaccurate reading from that TC bilirubin.
Huh. It makes good sense. I just had never
thought
about it. Although, to be fair, I had never actually done a TC bilirubin until about 6 months ago.
Okay.
So
true. The old center that we were in did not
do TC bilirubin. We just drew a serum because we were doing serums for everything anyway.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I feel like a lot of higher risk facilities don't do the TC bilirubin because you're drawing, probably getting a BMP at that point anyway.
And you just do it as an add-on.
And so you just do it as an add-on. So we talked about the TC bilirubin, and then every state has their own newborn metabolic screen.
Right.
And so those are the main tests that are done in newborn.
I feel like there was, does every baby get a hearing screen as well?
Oh, yes. Hearing screens. I forgot that. Yes.
I didn't know. I genuinely didn't know if that was an every baby thing or if that was a NICU thing.
So in our state, every baby is to get a hearing screen.
Got it. And then we talked about when babies this age aren't normal. Well, babies, typically it's blood sugars or that TTN.
There you go, thinking every baby's broken again.
They are. They're all broken.
Mm-hmm.
But we also talked
about... But not all dimples matter. So... True.
You're right.
I took embryology last summer and I was like, it is amazing to me how many people are born with the ability to function. There's so much has to happen. Okay.
A million things.
So I'm convinced that everybody has a weird dimple somewhere.
Yes.
But they don't all matter.
No. I used to teach a genetics lecture, and I'll never forget one of the nurses in my class saying...
Listeners, Michelle is dying over
here. She's dying quietly.
She's quietly dying.
One of the girls taking my class kept... Every time I said genetics, we were talking about syndactyly, and she was like, oh, I have that. And we were talking about webbing, and she... oh, I have that. And earlobes, and oh, I have that. And I finally looked at her and said, okay, please stop telling us, but you're right. We do all have something a little off.
Mm-hmm.
That's what makes us interesting.
Individual.
Right. Mm-hmm. What I wanted to say, though, was not actually that every baby was broken, even though I probably will always think that, but we skipped the gut part because a lot of duodenal atresia, jejunal atresia, a lot of Hirschsprungs, a lot of
malrotations,
volvuluses, incarcerated hernias, those things I feel like we don't find until we've tried to feed this baby for 24 hours.
And then they have
the nasty green bilious emesis.
Which, in case y'all don't know, that would be a tick. Every bilious emesis is a problem.
It's scary.
And it should be treated as a problem. I had somebody say one time when the baby threw up that it was, why are you getting so worked up? Because bile is supposed to go down.
And not up.
And not up. And if it's going up, it's a problem.
Yeah. Yep.
So I just wanted to touch on the gut part too, I think.
I think that's really important to impress on listeners is, yeah, when you have bilious, even bilious spit up, it should really make you cringe a little bit.
Yes.
Like, you need to call the nurse practitioner immediately. As a newborn nurse who was a NICU nurse, I know I definitely had an instance where a baby had been spitting up, and the mom came out of the room with a blanket, and I saw the blanket, and it was green. It was green spit up on the blanket, and I looked at her, and I said, did that come out of the baby? And she said, yes. And I said, what room are you in? And she was like, I'm in this room. I let my nurse know that the baby has been doing this for hours. And I got on the phone with the nurse practitioner. I said, you need to meet me in this room right now. And she was like, what baby is that? And I said, I don't even know. I don't even know what baby this is.
Michelle and I both got the dinner plate eyes because I can't imagine hours.
I can't either because in my mind, I'm going, this baby got really sick.
So here's the thing. And again, I had a baby in the NICU the other day who this spit up that I got from this baby, I'm not even convinced that it was green. I'm not. And I looked at it with the nurse practitioner and I said, I'm sorry to seemingly overreact. And she agreed with me. There's no overreacting when you think it's green.
I feel like guts in the NICU should always scare you a little.
Right. They go from functioning to dead.
Yes, quickly.
So fast.
And so when this mom came out, I wasn't even giving my coworker the opportunity to not call the nurse practitioner.
Right.
It was, I don't even know this baby. I need you here.
And I feel like that is an important piece of the NICU. That piece took me a long time to be okay with, but to know we are a team. This is part of your job. As an NP, you would hope that someone would call you so that you can conservatively, anticipatorily manage instead of now the baby is falling apart and it's an absolute emergency and we're calling in surgery and all the people. And as a nurse, I would rather you come put your eyes on it and then be like, Rebecca, you're overreacting than to, again, be in that situation where it's this huge thing.
Or on the flip side of that, I would want somebody to come and say to me, you're underreacting.
Yes.
Right.
Yes. And those teachable moments, I think, are important.
Yeah. And I know we've all had them in our career, those teachable moments. And I think it's important to always use them as teachable moments. Yeah. So we talked about hearts, guts. Kids with jaundice are staying in the rooms a lot longer than I feel like I saw before Break Baby Friendly.
Interesting.
I feel like we're kind of managing that. And I know that breastfeeding support is huge, but sometimes these kids, instead of taking them to the NICU, putting them on IV fluids, I've started seeing that babies are being fed formula.
Yes.
So it would be like breastfeed and then feed the baby formula, keep the baby under lights, and just getting that fluid into the babies and doing as much as we can to keep the baby in the room with the parents as we can before the decision is made to admit the baby to the NICU.
Right. True. But I also think, too, your technology comes into that with the Billy lights.
Yes.
And Billy the Billy blankets. Beds and the Billy blankets. You've got the Billy bed that has a higher light threshold that has this little jumpsuit looking thing that goes over it. The baby goes in and you zip them up in it. So you can lay there in just the diaper and get the full body effect. Or when I was, my youngest had some Billy issues, but I had the Billy bed for her. She was in the Billy bed. And then when I went to breastfeed her, I had a Billy blanket. So I put the blanket in the pad in the blanket as I swaddled her to put her to breast. So she was constantly under that. And it helped, like when visitors, when grandma and grandpa came in, we want to hold. Well, you still got to hold her with this blanket.
Right. Yes.
But they can hold.
But you can hold. Yep, exactly.
Y'all talking about technology earlier, you were talking about with the scans. It's hilarious to me to think that when I was born, the Billy solution was they told my mom to stick me in a window.
Mm-hmm. So funny story. You guys will appreciate this. My youngest had jaundice. We brought her home. And I want to say she was just a smidge below the light levels when we brought her home. And so my husband decided to put her near a window in the middle of January. And I said, what are you doing with our baby? And he said, well, she's jaundiced. So I put her in the light. And I said, these windows are UV treated.
Oh.
And so you're making my baby cold for nothing.
Right.
Poor baby.
Oh, poor baby.
She's well adjusted.
Oh, he tried, though.
Aw, he tried.
He gets bonus points for trying.
Making my baby cold for nothing.
For nothing. Isn't it fascinating the way the technology has changed?
It really is fascinating.
I feel like we'll do a whole episode on Billy too at some point because
we have
that's
to.
Such
I feel
a big
like
part of our population.
And so now we've mentioned three future episodes.
It's called foreshadowing.
It's foreshadowing. And I feel like this really, I thought this was going to be a much shorter episode because we're talking about healthy term babies that really should just, they should stay in the room and go home with mom and dad.
Right.
And, you know, it, obviously that doesn't always happen. So we kind of touched down on the things that we traditionally see with this population in the NICU. Definitely feel free to email us with questions. We love hearing from listeners.
And tell us your stories, too. You know, nurses love stories. I always want to hear everybody's stories about all the things all the time.
Yes, I love stories.
All right. So we will catch you guys in the next episode. Thanks for listening.